This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We appreciate you joining us on Trumpet Hour. We are ready, we're back and eager to discuss the important events of this past week. Here in the studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Pleasure to be here.
And from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And Andrew Miller, who is visiting there.
Good to be here.
And from our office in Jerusalem, we have Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
So we're going to start with a couple of stories highlighting the instability in the world today. Violence erupting because of efforts to redraw the world map. We're going to start in the Middle East. On September 25th, the Kurds in Iraq held a controversial independence referendum. 93% of the Kurds said, yes, we want to form a Kurdish state. Well, on Monday, the Iraqi government responded with a strong military response, and it has really lit this area on fire. It has major implications, not just for Iraq, but other neighbors as well, including Iran. For this story, we're going to go to our man in Jerusalem, Brent.
Yeah, this is a story that has been developing ever since that referendum, which, as you said, overwhelming support of Iraqi Kurds there in the north voted with their feet that they wanted to establish their own state. They've already had a kind of a semi-autonomous state in the northern part of Iraq, but they wanted full sovereignty over their territory. And of course, most nations in the world were against this. The Iraqis were definitely against this. The Iranians were against it. The Turks were against it. Even the United States, surprising some, were against this referendum. But considering how many of the Kurds wanted the cessation from Iraq, they looked like they were going to put up a fight and say, if you try and Iraqis can't try and take back this territory that we have fought for over the past 3 or 4 years from the Islamic State, then we're going to fight you. And yet, when the Iraqi forces started to roll towards the north, particularly the region around Kirkuk, the Peshmerga forces or the Kurdish forces in northern Iraq, looks like they ran. A lot of them left their posts. And now you have what seems to be fighting that's broken out between the Kurds, some of the Kurds, and Iraqi forces. Iranian Shiites as well that are pushing northward, really threatening even the future of the Kurdish region as a whole.
Okay, talk about the what are the stakes here? Why is it that, well, first of all, the Kurds there want independence. It does affect very directly Turkey and Iran. Obviously, just because the Kurds are in those areas as well. If Iraq Kurds have independence, that's going to encourage those who are in those other countries as well. But even just economically, what's at stake here for Iraq?
Well, this region that's just to the south of what was typically this autonomous region of Kurdistan in northern Iraq is this area of Kirkuk, around this major city of Kirkuk. And this is where the largest oil fields of Iraq are. And so from 2014, since the Kurdish forces fought back the Islamic State, they have been the ones that have controlled a lot of these oil resources. The Iraqi government did not want this. The Iranians, of course, did not want this as well. And so this is what the main point of contention is, this territory that's outside the semi-autonomous region already, and yet which is heavily made up of ethnic Kurds. And so Iran didn't want this to happen, where the Kurds would maintain not even their own state. I mean, the Kurds understood that by having this a referendum, they might not get their own state, but at least it would pressure Baghdad into giving them more favorable terms, maybe giving them or including this area of Kirkuk in their autonomous, semi-autonomous region. And yet that isn't going to happen, it looks now, because of the military incursion that the Iraqi government, as supported by the Iranian-backed Shiite militias, this incursion that they've made further north. And this is really important for a number of reasons. A number of people are writing on this. Some of my favorite commentators from the Middle East see how important this is right now. Carolyn Glick just wrote about this today, and she's entitled her article A Very Good Week, or Iran's Very Good Week. And she says that this came about, along with other reporting, that this came about, this incursion by Iraqi and Iranian-backed forces came about this week because of a visit by the Quds Force leader, the Iranian Quds Force leader, Qassem Soleimani. He's the guy that travels over the Middle East dictating Iranian policy. And he basically came to the Kurds, and the Kurds, they are made up of two main families, the Barzani family and the Talibanist family. And he talked to one of the Talibanist family, which were the major group inside the area of Kirkuk, and basically struck a deal with them and said, if you retreat right now, we are going to offer you favorable terms in this area. And note this, this isn't an Iraqi government official. This is an Iranian government official that's doing this negotiation inside Iraq. And because of this favorable negotiation, one of the families of the Kurds that make up the power half the power base, they said, "Fine, Iran, fine, Soleimani, we will retreat." So you had half the Kurdish fighters that were willing to stand up and fight, and then the rest that were retreating outside of this zone. And so this was Iranian instigated. This wasn't even Iraqi instigated. This was. Iran's goal was to ensure that a Kurdistan didn't happen and that Iran controlled this area around Kirkuk. We also have to remember, when we were talking about the Islamic State in Iraq, we've said that Iran is going to gobble up the territory inside Iraq that the Islamic State loses. And we've seen this through much of Iraq over the past year. Well, you had another group, the Kurds, that were also holding territory that formerly belonged to the Islamic State after they removed them. Iran didn't like this. Mm-hmm. Iran wants all of that territory, and so they are the ones that enacted this battle.
Yeah, Iran's very good week. It's certainly a strong picture of just how pervasive Iran's influence is within that part of Iraq and Iraq more broadly. Talk just a little bit to conclude. This is obviously something that it seems the United States would have a pretty strong interest in taking part in, trying to tamp things down. It seems like the fact that the United States is being so hands-off about this, certainly they've been aligned with the Kurds or allied with the Kurds and have a very strong interest in their alliance with the Iraqi government as well, after all of the blood and treasure that we've spilled in that country to try to bring it to the point that it is today. They're hands off. Iran is not at all. They're very, very involved. It gives a very strong picture of the state of that part of the world today.
Yeah, it certainly does. The United States, it seems, with their hands-off policy, is really upsetting the Kurds because they are one of the greatest allies of the United States in the region. It's kind of interesting because you have the incursion that's being made right now by the Iraqi government alongside the Iranian Shiite-backed militias. Are made with American weapons. Abrams tanks are rolling in to Kurdistan. And who are they facing off with? Against the Peshmerga, who also were sponsored by the United States, were given weaponry by the United States. And what we're seeing here is something in the Middle East like what happened back in 2005 in Georgia, when you had a strong American ally that was ready to stand up to Russia, and Russia rolled in with its tanks. Georgia thought the United States would do something. Well, the Peshmerga had every reason to think that the United States would come to their aid. Mm-hmm. And yet they have folded up completely and allowed Iran to take back this territory. And this could have repercussions across the Middle East. You've got the Kurdish forces that are fighting the Islamic State inside Syria. Now they're worried. Is the United States going to allow Assad to gobble up our territory like they have allowed the Iraqi government and Iran to gobble up the territory of the Kurds in Iraq? So this is damaging the United States' image, just like that just like what happened back in 2005 with allies in the Middle East. And something definitely that we're watching for, that is a trend that we've talked about, the United States exit from the Middle East, and that vacuum being filled by Iran, which the Bible calls the King of the South, which we've said is going to dominate Iraq. The Kurds, they were a obstacle for Iran's complete domination of Iraq. And now, by effectively removing them from this territory and effectively dividing the Kurdish government the Iranians have now, installing a puppet government inside the Kurdish government, now we can say that the Kurds are no longer a threat to their total takeover of Iraq.
Extraordinary. Where would you send people who wanted more information about this? That what you were just saying there certainly points back to statements that the Trumpet's editor-in-chief made years, decades ago about what was going to happen in Iraq.
Yeah, we can leave a link to the article back in 2003 when our editor-in-chief wrote about Iraq falling to Iran. While it doesn't really mention the Kurds too much in there, the Kurds historically haven't been an ally of Iran, and they threaten Iran's domination of Iraq. So we can see that playing into this, that Iran is taking over Iraq. But then you can also read the booklet, The King of the South. The King of the South, it's going to guide your understanding of the Middle East, and so much of it is coming to fruition right now.
All right. Well, thanks for that, Brent. Europe is experiencing its own crisis as a result of a bid for independence. This in the Spanish region of Catalonia. A referendum was held there on October 1st, just a week after the one in Kurdistan. This is also creating massive problems in Spain and has troubling implications for the whole of Europe. For this story, we'll go to Britain and Richard.
Yes, I think we spoke about this last time we were on a few weeks ago. And since then, the situation has continued to escalate. Really, the Spanish government has not, you know, kind of like the Iraqi government, not backed down, not given any ground. The situation right now is the government has said it's going to activate Article 155. And this has been referred to throughout the whole kind of thing situation as the nuclear option. So what they're doing, Catalonia voted to declare independence. The government said, well, you know, we want to clarify, are you declaring independence or not? The Catalonian government has refused to clarify. And so then the Spanish central government says, well, we're going to activate this article. What that means is it means that they essentially take over running Catalonia. They'll take over, you know, a lot of the state's powers. The government will take those. They're also talking about, they'll probably end up dissolving the cabinet, getting rid of the state president, and eventually holding fresh elections. At the same time, they've also been arresting and locking up leaders of some of the Spanish independence movements, which, especially in Spain, is something with kind of very troubling historical echoes. You know, these are political prisoners, people being locked up because of their politics. And, you know, Spain is a modern functioning democracy, but that still carries echoes of the Franco regime that lasted all the way up until the late 70s. So some fairly dramatic developments. I think it's hard to get a read on how Catalonia will respond to this, at least for me looking at this from the outside at the moment. I mean, on the one hand, I could see this make them explode. Mm-hmm. You know, if the government, they vote for independence and the government responds by taking away whatever regional independence they have as it is within the nation, firing the politicians, having fresh elections.
Right.
However, I think there's also the possibility that if fresh elections are there and certain, then maybe that will calm things down in that those that feel angry about this know that they still have a chance to express their opinion coming a few weeks down the line, and that rather than, you know, rioting or anything like that, they'll wait and they'll vote. So I think I've seen commentators kind of talking both ways. There's also signs of this kind of thinking spreading. So for example, there's a couple of Italian regions now have said they're going to hold their own referenda. And I don't think it's on exactly independence, but certainly on much less government rule. So this has now caused independence movements all across Europe just to kind of sit up and take notice.
So you have you said this a few weeks ago, and you're kind of underlining that a little bit today. Just the fact that this does show kind of the I guess autocratic heart of Europe, in a sense, that they're willing to, in a situation like this, take whatever measures they need to in order to get the result that they want. Speaking of the Eurocrats, speaking of the kind of the European establishment, what are some lessons that you take from this, even with the situation at play? Not quite sure exactly how this is going to unfold, but what lessons can we take from this, watching what's happened to this point?
Yeah, it is an interesting situation. Like you said, I think there's a lot of people now, more and more I've seen, calling out the European Commission on their hypocrisy. And you put this, it's interesting to kind of put this alongside of what we were talking about on Wednesday, where we were talking about the new kind of European leaders that are emerging in Eastern Europe. And we were talking about Sebastian Kurz, we were talking about some of these other ones, and they're emerging in Eastern Europe, and the European Commission doesn't like those. It's cracking down on them. It's trying to deny them their voting rights, that kind of thing. And by any unbiased empirical standard, Catalonia or the Spanish government is behaving far worse in all of the categories that they're talking about than, say, Poland is, when it comes to some of these things like rule of law. And even I saw an article by a lawyer that gone through and showed some of the things that the Spanish government had done with their judiciary and the background to this were exactly the same as the things the European Commission is protesting Poland doing. Mm-hmm. And when we were talking on Wednesday, we were kind of talking about Eastern Europe, those leaders are rising. They're kind of the future of Europe. And this whole situation, I think, undermines the moral authority and just even the leadership of the old Europe, say the Europe of the European Commission, the Europe of these bureaucrats. And I think it is interesting you put those side by side. Are we seeing right now the twilight of, say, the Europe that's led from Brussels? It is a big problem for them. And at the same time, this Catalonia crisis, it's one among many crises in Europe. It also has the potential, as I was just talking about with even Italy, with Milan and Venice kind of voting on greater autonomy, it's something that has the potential to cause long-ranging crises for all of Europe. There are all these different enclaves and border regions that don't make sense. So it also just increases the pressure on Europe to find some good leadership, mm-hmm, and some solid leadership. So I think it's just one step along the process to a Europe that's not led by squabbling bureaucrats, but one led by strong men and strong leaders. And as we've said for years, the ultimate strong man and strong leader is going to come from Germany. And that's really the logical outcome, with Germany being the already kind of seen as the de facto leader of Europe.
So just to inform the listeners' view of Europe from a prophetic standpoint, you mentioned this about the coming strong man, but looking at what's going on in here in Catalonia, what literature would you point them to give greater context?
There's quite a few, but I think one of the main ones I'd highlight now is the booklet He Was Right, because that talks about a lot of what's coming for Europe, but it also goes through and talks about or shows how much of all of this was prophesied in advance and how much has already happened. It goes through what Herbert W. Armstrong talked about with Europe, how he talked about how it would be led from Germany, how Germany was the heart of Europe, and that was something that was almost unbelievable back in, say, 1946. And that booklet goes through and charts all of those prophecies, all of those forecasts. And you can see how so many of those have been fulfilled already. And then the ones that haven't give you a great outline of showing where Europe's going from here on out.
All right. Excellent. Thanks for that very much. Richard, you're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. A discussion we tend to have a lot at the among the staff of the Trumpet is just how much the world is empowering autocrats and dictators. Richard was alluding to that just in his previous piece there. But we see this trend in several nations, and it's happening in a big way in China. More evidence this week of how China's President Xi Jinping could be steering his country into something like a new Maoist era. For this, we'll turn to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, some have called Chinese President Xi Jinping a 21st century Mao Zedong. Others have called him China's equivalent to Vladimir Putin. But on Wednesday morning, Mr. Xi actually seemed to be channeling the late Fidel Castro, because he delivered a 3.5 hour long speech, just really testing the eyelids and the bladders of his fellow communist leaders. This speech was, it was Xi's opening to the Chinese Communist Party's 19th Congress. This is a hugely important event for China that occurs every 5 years, and the meeting typically lasts for about a week. And in this opening marathon speech, Xi basically laid out his vision for the Communist Party, for China, and for the world. And his main talking points were that the U.S. is retreating on the world stage, and that China should be the one to fill that void. He said China should lead the world in environmental stewardship and in safeguarding globalization. He also said that the political system of sort of what he called socialism with Chinese characteristics is a model that developing nations all over the world should look to and emulate if they would like to have an economic rise such as the one that China has enjoyed while they simultaneously safeguard their independence. Mr. Xi also said that China's making good progress in its drive to become rich, strong, and powerful, but that there's still a really long way to go. And he laid out some concrete goals. He said that China will totally wipe out poverty in its rural areas by 2021. He also said that the country will become fully developed by 2049, which is the 100th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. So in most ways, this was what analysts kind of expected from Xi's opening speech, with the exception of the length. At one point during his delivery, he actually had someone serve tea to him while he kept on talking, which just indicates how long it was. But really the most significant part of this party congress is that it gives Xi Jinping a chance to bend some rules regarding Chinese leadership in a way that could really tighten his already very tight hold on power. It could see him become a full authoritarian leader, like you mentioned at the beginning there. There's one guideline that says anyone 68 years old or older is not eligible to be appointed or reappointed to the Politburo Standing Committee, which is the small group of elites that really run China. But there's one member of the committee, the 69-year-old Wang Qishan, who's really become Xi's right-hand man in a lot of ways over the years. And experts say that Xi will very likely bend these rules to allow Wang to remain on the committee. And this alone may not be hugely significant, but if Xi bends those rules to allow Mr. Wang to have an additional term, then that would pave the way for Xi himself to bypass the limits on his own tenure. Mm-hmm. There's supposed to be a limit of 2 5-year terms for his offices, but it looks like he could very easily use this as precedent to bypass those rules and remain China's leader beyond 2022, which is when his leadership is supposed to come to an end. So this would be similar to what Vladimir Putin has done in Russia, basically rewriting the political rule book to allow himself to rule for as long as he wants to. So it is, you know, it's something that the Trumpet will be carefully watching, because during his first 5 years in power, Xi has already built a very strong personality cult. He's consolidated his personal power to levels not seen in China for decades. And if he starts bending rules like this to allow himself to basically have total power, that would lay the groundwork for the fulfillment of, you know, Bible prophecies regarding China that the Trumpet is watching for. Bible prophecy reveals that as America's influence on the international stage continues to decline, there will be two power blocks that emerge in its place. One is a European entity that's operating in the tradition of the Holy Roman Empire, and then the other is an Asian bloc called in Scripture the Kings of the East, and it's headed by Russia, but then China's there in kind of a secondary leadership position. And if you look at Bible chapters such as Jeremiah 50, Daniel 11, Revelation 16, you see that the Bible says that there will be a massive clash between these two blocks, this European one and the Russo-Chinese-led Asian power. So Xi's tightening control over China's military and every other aspect of China is really vital to watch with these Bible prophecies in mind, because it gives us an indication of how the Chinese president could fall in line with his fellow strongman there in Russia. It gives us clues about how China will be brought into this prophesied collision course with Europe, and it also shows just how near this future clash is.
Yeah, I would encourage listeners to go online to thetrumpet.com. Jeremiah actually has an article up there called Is Xi Jinping About to Make a Major Push in Bringing China into Another Maoist Era? And he goes into some detail in these prophecies that he was just mentioning there. Any other literature that you might point people to in order to give more context?
Yes. Yeah, there's an article by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury. It's called China is Steering the World Toward War. And it does a really powerful job just showing how powerful and how pushy China is becoming. And it also shows that China's rise under Xi Jinping is connected to World War III, essentially. And the best imaginable news that's just saturated with hope. So this article, China is Steering the World Toward War, is a really powerful one, and we'll have a link to it in the show notes there.
All right. Well, thanks, Jeremiah. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. A bit of economic news now. What will happen the next time America experiences a recession? Well, a new report gives a troubling picture of just how unprepared individual states would be to weather that storm. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this really seems to be a big problem with throughout all levels of society in the United States. You'll remember the lesson from the Bible from the time of Joseph, when it said that, you know, he had the 7 years of famine and you 7 years of plenty. And you stored grain, and so that when 7 years of famine came, you actually had something to fall back on. And in the United States, and many other nations, we've reported on this before, how individuals aren't saving enough for an emergency, and how the federal government definitely isn't saving enough for emergency. And now I said even this new report shows that even state governments are vastly underfunded if another economic turndown were to happen. Right now, the economy has been relatively good, especially since the election of President Donald Trump. There's been a lot of optimism, but it doesn't seem like state governments have capitalized on this good economic times to try to put stuff away. According to this new report here from Moody's Analytics, there's actually only 16 states, less than half, actually getting down close to a quarter of them, have adequate money on hand, like I said, if a recession were to come and hit the region. Alaska being the best position, one of the states that actually does have quite a bit of money saved away, and Louisiana being the worst.
So if there were a recession, then you're basically talking about the people in these states having trouble. The tax revenues would go down, unemployment would go up, people looking for government benefits would go up. Maybe just talk about the ramifications of what we're talking about that would put pressure on state coffers.
Right, because right now unemployment's fairly low and the economy has quite a bit of optimism, so it hasn't been a huge problem. But they said, like you said, when the next recession comes, obviously recession comes, more people are unemployed, more people are unemployed. That means tax revenues are going to go down, demand for welfare checks is going to go up, demand for food stamps is going to go up, demand for like government health care programs like Medicaid is going to go up. And if the states don't have a rainy day fund to bridge the gap when these tax revenues are down, that's going to be putting it in a situation where the only way that it can start funding these more demand for Medicare and unemployment benefits is through borrowing.
I saw a similar paper this week that sounds very similar, warning. It's from the Government Accounting Office, and they produced an examination of the nation's retirement system. It was a report for Congress, and it was it was basically saying that America is, you know, sounding the warning about what's going to happen as people start retiring and the funds that are in place for the retirement system. Basically, they said if nothing is done, then the government, starting in 2035, the government will not be able to pay out the promised benefits. So if you're more than 20 years away from retirement, the government's not going to be able to give you what they've said they're going to give you, according to this latest report. It was also talking about just how unfunded private workplace pensions are. This is a government report. I see reports almost every week from different places just talking about how the states don't have enough money to pay what they've promised. And that's a hard benefit to take away. You know, people, the way they see it, they've paid money into these retirement plans all their lives in the form of Social Security. There's just more and more states saying, okay, yep, like Andrew was saying, we're not planned for emergencies and we're not even planned for what we know is coming. We can't cover those costs.
Mm-hmm. So, Andrew, if you just to point people to something that would give them more information about this, what would you do?
Right. Well, that's definitely something that people are going to need to realize is that the government's not prepared for these type of crises. So you have to make good financial decisions in your own personal life. And more than that, you need God's blessing in your own personal life. It's said that God helps those that help themselves, but you'll need both his blessing and be making sound financial decisions based on biblical wisdom. And we actually do produce a free booklet titled How to Solve Your Financial Problems that does go through and gives a lot of good sound financial advice on things like retirement savings and emergency savings based on principles from the Bible, and then also shows even from like a moral angle the type of things that will help bring God's blessing and protection into your life.
Well, thanks for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about how Europe is responding to Donald Trump's decertifying the nuclear deal with Iran, Russia's impressive advanced missile system, and which countries are purchasing it for their own use. And we'll get a bit of news about a country we don't hear much about, but that one of our writers recently visited, Nepal. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Last week, U.S. President Donald Trump refused to certify the nuclear deal with Iran. He said they were not upholding their end of the deal. We talked about this on Wednesday's program and how many nations said this was a disastrous move by the American president. Among those nations were the major powers in Europe. President Trump's move forces them now to make a choice. Do they break with the United States or do they confront Iran? To learn about why this is an important moment of truth for Europe, we're going to go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, so this is going to be eagerly watched over the next 2 months, how European nations react to what looks to be Congress's, well, we'll see whether Congress ends up following through and whether they back up the president with this in with the Iranian nuclear deal, whether they decided to add sanctions back on the Iranian regime. And we have Europe waiting and watching because this will have a huge effect on them. They were really quick and the outset of the nuclear deal being signed to rush into Tehran with a lot of different business deals to work with the Iranian regime. Airbus had a number of deals. Automakers from Germany had a number of deals with Iran. And so they are now in the situation where if the United States sanctions Iran once again, then they're going to have to choose, because they're going to either want to be in business with the United States, or are they going to continue to be in business with Iran? So they're at a really these 2 next months are going to be a high pressure environment for European leaders, both for their relationship with Iran and the United States.
Yeah, we talked about this when that deal went into place, just how, as you mentioned, how quick all of these nations were to resume business with Iran. And at that time, we were talking about how it just seemed extremely unlikely, as much as you had provisions within the deal that said that the sanctions would snap back if Iran didn't participate and so on, if they were not compliant, that would have resumed. They would have resumed those punitive measures against Iran. Now we have a situation where you look at President Trump's reasons for not certifying the deal. It seems like he's got a pretty strong case here, and yet the reaction of all of these nations is pretty much exactly what we expected to happen if we ended up in a situation like this.
Yeah, getting the United States, getting the other nations along with the United States to all agree once again to financial sanctions on Iran was going to be a hard task. That's why they weren't snapped back, because once the Europeans, the Russians, the Chinese, who were all in agreement originally with sanctions on Iran, once they started doing these deals and really investing heavily inside Iran, it was going to be very hard for them to then pull back out. And that's obviously something we drew attention to, and it was one of the big flaws of the Iran nuclear deal was it's going to be impossible to increase that pressure on Iran once again. And so we have the Europeans that are facing this dilemma. Do they side with the United States? Try to pressure the United States to follow through on the deal, to keep the deal, so that they can continue to strengthen their economic interests in the country. The Wall Street Journal had an article about this this week. It was entitled, this is from the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal, it was entitled Europe's Iranian Moment of Truth. And I'd just like to quote from that because I think it brings some clarity to what we're talking about right now. It says the question for Europe is whether to double down on its investment of political capital and its own credibility in a deal Washington increasingly scorns and whose spirit Tehran habitually violates. And it's saying the main transatlantic crisis that could emerge will be if London, Paris, and Berlin, the three EU governments that co-signed the 2015 deal, conclude that business interests with Tehran are more important than helping Washington enforce counter-proliferation measures. So they're weighing this up. They see what the United States sees. They see Iran not coming back into the community of nations, which was hoped for by the European nations. They see Iran continue its ballistic missile development technology. They see the flaws in the deal. Even they've said the sunset clause in 2025 with Iran, the French leader has said that's a bad part of the deal. They see all this. So really with their brain, or as far as if there weren't any financial interests involved, you would think that they would side with the United States, but there are so many financial interests that they might be willing to go along with Iran at the expense of the United States relationship for a little bit longer going forward.
Well, put this in a prophetic context. Obviously, we're going to find out quite soon, first of all, how much the United States follows through with this, what legislators do in the United States in response to the president's move. But then we'll find out how Europe responds. How do you see this going? And say, just looking at this from a prophetic standpoint, what might we see play out?
So there are two things that are interesting here. They've got two prophecies that we're looking for, both of them are at play here. One is a future division between the United States and Europe, particularly Germany. And we've seen that especially pick up pace over the past year since President Trump has been in power. European nations, especially Germany, seem to, and German politicians seem to have a dislike for Mr. Trump. And so that is playing out in this rift right now, that they are willing to sacrifice the longstanding relationship with the United States over the Iran deal. So we have that. But also, I think a more important element to this, and what the Wall Street Journal's headline really draws attention to, is that there is a coming moment of truth for Europe on the issue of Iran. Iran's not going away. They're only getting stronger in the Middle East. They look like they are marching towards a nuclear bomb. They're certainly increasing their potential to deliver those weapons around the world. And there is a moment of truth that is coming. And prophecy dictates that Europe will eventually become much stronger on Iran, much stronger than even the United States is on Iran. So they are going to make a turn, as the Wall Street Journal says. Whether this is going to be it or not, Bible prophecy says that will happen.
Right. Strategic considerations are going to win out over any economic benefits
eventually,
that they might get.
Yeah, eventually that will happen for sure.
It is interesting how Donald Trump seems to be forcing the issue in so many of these arenas that what's happening with Iran here with respect to Europe. I mean, in a sense, when Europe began to flood into Iran with all of these business deals, it did seem somewhat counter to what you would expect, just knowing how that relationship is going to play out prophetically.
Exactly. But I think they're looking at this and they see a short-term gain here. Short-term economic interests are outweighing what they see as short-term dangers. But at some point, there is going to be a clear and present danger threat from Iran on Europe. And that seems to be what will switch them to opposing Iran.
If you want to read more about this, you can go online to thetrumpet.com. Anthony Chabarway has an article there called A Nuclear Armed Iran is Coming, just talking about the fallout of President Trump's move here and just how it seems no matter what direction we go that Iran is going to end up with the weapons that it seeks. Well, thank you for that, Brent. Russia has been marketing an advanced anti-aircraft, anti-missile system and getting significant business from a number of nations. This works against the interests of both Europe and America, and it actually has significant potential to affect the situation in the Middle East. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Russia has struck a very significant deal with Saudi Arabia to sell its advanced S-400 air defense missile system to the Saudis. Vladimir Kozin, who is an aide to Russian President Vladimir Putin, told Interfax News Agency about this deal on October 13th. And part of the reason why this is so significant is because at this point it's not just Saudi Arabia, but also Egypt and Turkey that are in the process of buying this stunningly advanced missile system from Russia. So experts are saying that this could be a real game changer for the Middle East, mostly because of the S-400's ability to fire multiple intercept missiles. The S-400 supports four different missiles, ranging from the short-range 9M96E, which goes about 25 miles, all the way up to the very long-range 40N6E series, which can go about 10 times that far, 250 miles. So this variability gives the system a capacity far beyond even the U.S.'s Patriot system, which supports only one interceptor missile with a range of about 60 miles. The S-400 also fires 9M96E2 missiles, which are really considered the jewels of the system. These fly at about Mach 15, that's over 11,000 miles per hour, and they can engage targets as low as 15 feet off the ground. So it's a remarkably fast and agile missile that can knock out penetrating aircraft and missiles that are flying just above the ground. It can also neutralize cruise missiles. And experts also say that the S-400's acquisition radars can defeat even the most advanced modern stealth aircraft, like the F-22 and the F-35. But it is unclear at this point if Russia will be including these radar enhancements on the S-400s that it's selling to Saudi Arabia and these other Middle Eastern nations. But even if that radar is not included, these Russian sales point to two Bible prophecies that the trumpet is watching for. One is the decline of American influence in the Middle East and beyond. Brent talked about this earlier, with America being just outmaneuvered by Iran. And we are also seeing America being outmaneuvered by Russia in the Middle East, time and again, even in nations that have been U.S. client countries for many years, like Saudi Arabia. And in Leviticus 26, verse 19, God warns America that because of its disobedience, he will break the pride of U.S. power. So these game-changing Russian sales are just one of many factors showing that American influence is being broken in the Middle East. And then this also points to Russia's return to superpower status, which is prophesied in such Bible passages as Ezekiel 38 and Revelation 16:12. Revelation 9 has a lot to say about it as well, and many other passages. The Bible shows that Russia will be at the head of a very powerful bloc of Asian nations, and that it will play a major role in a third world war which will culminate in the return of Jesus Christ. So these passages are all explained in great detail in Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury's booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia. It's a very powerful booklet that lays all these prophecies out clearly and just shows how they are being fulfilled in today's headlines. So if any listeners have not read that, I would encourage them to go to thetrumpet.com and check that booklet out.
Any sense of what the, say, specific strategic ramifications of Saudi Arabia having this kind of technology, Turkey, Egypt, this is an area, obviously, that it's very volatile. And there's a lot of, you could see why these nations would be seeking this kind of technology, but these specific capabilities that this missile system gives them, any sense of how that could change things?
Well, it's a defense missile system, so it basically just make them far less vulnerable to attacks by other countries, by jets flying into their airspace, by missiles coming into their airspace. They would be able to neutralize any such threats. Not all of them, but they would be equipped to deal with missiles from whatever other power, America or anyone else, flying into their airspace. They could shoot those down, intercept them, and render the incoming aircraft or missiles just powerless, basically.
It is interesting that Russia is making this deal with Saudi Arabia in particular. It's been such a strong ally of Iran in so many situations, and we've been tracking the way that relationship has kind of it's hit some rocky patches over the last several months. I would think that Iran would be not too keen to see Saudi Arabia getting this kind of technology. Perhaps even Turkey, another hegemon in the region that is maybe competing for dominance regionally. Just how this plays out. Russia just, it definitely seems to continually be inserting itself into the mix in ways. You see its relationship with Syria and the way that it has steered events toward its own interests in that area. Mm-hmm. Just how this might play out, what Russia might be up to more broadly in the region. Well, we appreciate that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program. We have one more story. Our own Andrew Miller is on a round trip tour of the world, apparently. He's been in Asia for a few weeks. Now he's in England for a couple more. One stop on his round the world trip in 80 days was Kathmandu in Nepal. And he's here to talk about some of the geopolitical forces that are shaping events in that country and in Asia more broadly. So, Andrew, what say you?
Yeah, well, actually, you said I just got in from Kathmandu very recently, actually. So recently that I'm still in hiking clothes here in the studio. I normally dress a little more upscale than that. But it was a really amazing experience over there. We've got an article that's getting ready to go up on thetrumpet.com, just kind of showing how the rise of China is really starting to change things in Nepal. Most of the people I was able to talk to there were from the Sherpa family, and they're a little more divided. They do like a lot of the development and the investment China's brought to their country, which is the 144th poorest country in the United Nations. But there is also some legitimate concern about the China's efforts to squelch culture in Tibet, which is has mm-hmm. a very similar culture to at least the mountainous regions of Nepal. Mm-hmm. And even just before I got there, the two largest communist parties in Nepal, the Leninist Party and the Maoist Party, just merged. And both of them have much closer relations to China than the current ruling coalition. The Maoist Party fought a civil war against the now deposed monarchy in Nepal for 10 years, just ending finally in 2006. One of the guides I met there said that he'd moved to Kathmandu in 2004 just because of the the militia movements in his home village was making it dangerous for his children to go to school there. They're having elections later next month in November. It's really doubtful, this, even with these new Leninist and Maoist merging into a new communist party, that they'll form a majority. But it will still be a very powerful minority that will make it much harder for Nepal to make any sorts of decisions that would be unpopular with Politburo in China.
Well, in this this article that you've put together, you just mentioned Mr. Armstrong's work in that area. Maybe you could just talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, he did quite a – I think Mr. Armstrong, Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong went down there the first time in the mid-70s and was very active in with the Ambassador Cultural – International Cultural Foundation for a good two decades, help building schools in the western parts of the country and donating some to the World Wildlife Fund. And having met with two successive kings of Nepal. This is back before the monarchy was finally deposed in 2008. And he really did powerfully bring, at least to the leaders of that nation, a message that world peace and prosperity isn't going to come until human nature's been changed. But his efforts to bring funding schools, especially in more of these some of the remote cities closer to where I was hiking, really did change a lot of lives in that area. So I hadn't really come across people in that particular area who remembered him, but he did have, especially with the royal family, a very big impact on that nation, probably compared to many other nations in the world.
All right. Well, that will do it for us today for Trumpet Hour. Go ahead and visit thetrumpet.com to look up the show notes for the program today. You can find the links to the booklets and the stories that we talked about on today's program. You can also give us your feedback on the show today by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much to this panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having us.
It's been fun.
Been good to be here.
Good to be here.
And thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Evan Asar. You can't do anything about the length of your life, but you can do something about its width and depth. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.